Yesterday, about this Infinitum thing. Feel free to go online, access it, tell us what you think, give us some feedback, just hope it's helpful. And we invite you to journey with us if that's what you'd like to do. And it's just there as a resource. And what I want to do in this session, this is more of kind of a workshop, this session before our final session. It's not kind of a Bible teaching or anything, although I will refer to a couple of passages of Scripture, just to kind of equip us to do the things that we say we want to do, to be the men we say we want to be, to transform the way we say we want to be transformed. And church is sometimes a kind of very serious place. And I grew up as a young boy in church in the Salvation Army. And I got to be honest, Sunday mornings sometimes were the single most boring place on the face of planet Earth. Unbelievable. They were the holiness meetings from hell. They were atrocious, you know. And we get so bored. And I can't ever remember anything interesting happening apart from the once when a fire extinguisher went off. I can't ever remember one exciting thing happening as a child. But I wish I'd have been in the church when this particular thing happened. And I am told this is true. Okay? So imagine for yourself Ebenezer Baptist Church in a place called Illinois. I think it's Illinois. And it's one of the old Baptist churches with kind of a wrap-round balcony. Okay? And then a lower a kind of ground floor level. And apparently, what would happen is the kind of conservative folks in this church would tend to stay upstairs. And it ended up this kind of bizarre divide where the kind of really expressive kind of new Pentecostal charismatic types, they'd be on the ground floor. And the far more conservative reserve, ladies and gentlemen, would be up in the balcony. So a friend tells this story about, on this particular occasion, it was on the stage, on the platform, and was looking out at the crowd. And it came to the beginning of the service, and he said, in a few moments' time, we're going to pray. And so, it was quite a traditional church, so he was going to read a doxology. He said, let us pray. And at that point, two things happened. One of the more conservative gentlemen at the front of the balcony, at the back bit, did what conservative people do. They do a kind of Germanic Nazi thing that when someone says pray, they go, let us pray, Lord, and did that. At which point, his not very secure toupee fell off and began to plummet towards the ground floor. On the ground floor were the more Pentecostal charismatic types. And when the pastor said, let us pray, he didn't do that, but went like that, saying, Lord, what is it you want to give me today? And that in itself was funny. And it was kind of sitting there, oh, Lord, does that? And suddenly this toupee lands in his hands. That was bad enough. But the guy, quite surprised that God has heard his prayer so clearly, opens his eyes, sees the toupee in his hands, sees that the guy in front of him is bald, assumes it's his and sticks it on his head. Can you imagine being at service? Anyway, so what I think about is just change. And just please assume that behind everything I'm talking about is obviously the work of the Holy Spirit is the only one that can help us to change. So please assume that. Sometimes when I do stuff like this, people say to me, oh, you didn't mention the Holy Spirit enough. Let us be grown-ups and say that's the assumption in the room, that everything is only possible by the grace and the power of the Spirit of Jesus. Okay? Is that all right with everyone? So if I don't say the Holy Spirit enough, please forgive me, okay? But we're all grown-ups. We know that it's only by his grace that it's possible, okay? And change, whatever the change is, be it organizational change or be it personal change, these four things that we're going to talk about now are immutable truths, okay? Change is only possible when these four things are present, yeah? Be it the changing of a personal habit, yeah? Be it the changing of an organization, be it the change of a circumstance, be it a change in our behaviors, whatever it is, It will only take place if these four things are present. Number one, dissatisfaction with the status quo. Dissatisfaction with the status quo. I don't like the way we do things around here. I don't like, this isn't good enough. I want things to be different. I want things to change. This doesn't work for me, etc., etc., etc. Change has to begin with dissatisfaction with the status quo, with what is real now. So on a personal level, I'm someone who struggles with sin. You knew this, I know, but let me make another self-evidential truth. I'm not only a big mouth, I'm also a deeply flawed human being. And the question I'm often challenged about, which an old pastor said to me once, was, Phil, do you hate your sin enough? Do you hate your sin enough? Because actually, if I think about that as a human being, sometimes I've nurtured my sin. Sometimes I've tolerated my sin. Sometimes I've given my sin permission to hang around for a bit longer, because frankly, it's quite enjoyable. Question, do I hate my sin enough? Unless there's dissatisfaction with the status quo, it won't happen. Okay? Worked for the Salvation Army for 12 years. Spent 12 years doing my best with a whole bunch of other people, soldiers and friends of Salvation Army, officers of Salvation Army, trying to bring about change. And the reality is, no matter what people said, many people weren't dissatisfied with the status quo. They are quite happy that their denomination is dying and lost people aren't finding Jesus and that they get to sing the songs they've sung for the last 124 years as long as they don't have to change. They are not dissatisfied with the status quo, no matter what they say, because the price of change is too high. And one of the great challenges that leaders have, James knows this, I know this, we all know this. And having seen some things that I've led fail, I know this is true. We lead organizations to growth, we also lead organizations to decline. It's what we do as leaders, we have to take it on the chin. Buck starts with us, we're leaders, goes with the territory. How dissatisfied are you with your status quo? Whatever it is you want to change in your life, in your church, in your business, in your marriage, whatever. Are you dissatisfied enough? Because change is only possible once you're dissatisfied enough. And sometimes dissatisfaction can be a shock, and sometimes it's a longer-term revelation. But the issue is, are you dissatisfied enough? Secondly, is there an inspiring vision of the future? Is there an inspiring vision of the future? What is it you want to get done? And what's really interesting, if I may reflect personally for a second, is this kind of we see hope thing. I could not live with myself if I walked away from this. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, because I made a promise. Getting all emotional in my old age, forgive me. I made a promise to that little girl. They haven't failed to adopt her, though I think the ending for her was a good ending. I would spend the rest of my life doing my very best to do something about the millions, 15 million boys and girls like her in Africa. If you were to find out that actually I've just gone to live on a kind of, you know, Caribbean island and kind of see my, I just couldn't live with myself. Yeah? Because I've been captivated by an inspiring vision. People sometimes call me naive. I said, I'm not naive, but I am an idealist. Trust me, I am not naive. I have seen some harsh life. I have seen some really, really harsh things. I've been involved in some really, really challenging things. I am not naive. Because naivety and realism aren't opposites. Naivety and realism aren't opposites. Idealism and realism aren't opposites. Yes? Idealism and cynicism are opposites. I'm an idealist. And I choose to believe that we can change the world. I really do. I really believe we can change the world. I believe Jesus has the power to change the world. I believe the local church is the hope of the world. And I believe that we can change the world. And I believe the impact that we can make is quite extraordinary. Young man here, Jared. Are you still here, Jared? Can't see you, buddy, because the lights are on. Are you still here? Jared asked me a question. I said, what about his generation? The opportunity for your generation is quite extraordinary. With the onset of digital technology and the revolution taking place around communication around the world, your opportunity to influence the world is extraordinary, greater than ever before. You are the most digitally literate and informed generation of all of human history. Your opportunity is extraordinary. The only question is, will you? That's the only question. That's the only question. Will you have the courage to give it a shot? Have you been captivated by an inspiring vision to change the world? That's the second thing that needs to be present if change is going to take place, be it an organization, be it orphans in Africa, or be it your personal life. Third thing is, you've got to have a plan. You've got to have a plan. What's going to be different tomorrow? What's the plan? What are you going to do? Okay, you need a plan. That if you're in a vulnerable place and you're doing bad things, you're in a vulnerable place, you get yourself out of a vulnerable place. Or if your organization's doing this in, week out, week in, week out, and it's doing nothing, we need to change to do this thing week in, week out. Because doing the same thing every week and expecting a different result next week is called insanity or bonkers. It just doesn't work. The Salvation Army, I'm part of it in the UK, we seem to have this sentimental view. Having done the same things in many places for very, very long, that if he's doing that, something will happen somewhere and suddenly things will be different. It's called idiocy. So there needs to be a plan. There needs to be a plan. It needs to be a divinely inspired plan, but there needs to be a plan. You need to have a plan. If you want your life to be different, if you want your behaviors to be different, if you want your marriage to be different, if you want your family to be different, if you want your business to be different, whatever, you gotta have a plan, not just hope. I'd love to bore you for the next 6 hours with our strategic plan for the next 15 years. We have a plan. We're not just storytellers. We really, really have a plan. And then finally, we have accountability. We have accountability. A plan without accountability. Do you know what that's called? A plan without accountability? Do you know what it's called? Wishful thinking. Wishful thinking. Dissatisfaction with status quo? Tick. Inspiring vision of the future? Absolutely. We got a plan? Yep. No accountability. Wishful thinking and nothing else. Because you will not execute if you're not accountable. Why? Because our human brains are orientated towards the status quo. Our human brains are always orientated back to the norm, the way things should be, the way things are. Do any of you here have any kind of obsessive behaviors, like ADD or ADHD, like I do? Anyone still have that here? Anyone? Yeah, I certainly do. And my daughter has this OCD thing. We went to a friend's house a little while ago, and we walked in here. It's a very big house, and very big house, ridiculous house for one family to live in. And the kind of wardrobe, the closet off the main bedroom, is bigger than my bedroom in the house. And we walked in there, we've been showing this amazing house, and Yasmin suddenly runs over and bends down and says, "What are you doing?" And she saw that there were two light switches, but there was no plugs in, and one of the plugs was switched on. So she had to go turn it off because of this OCD thing, isn't it? And what happens is, because our brains are orientated towards sameness, is she saw this and said, "Ah, something's wrong, fix it." Why? Because our brains are orientated towards sameness, i.e. the status quo. I'm going to prove that to you. Would you all do this, please? All do this. Just do that. Clasp your hands together. So how many of you are like me that your right hand little finger is on the bottom? Some of you are struggling. Put your hands up if your right hands are on the bottom. Okay, bless you. Put your hands down. Put your hands up if your left hand is on the bottom. Okay, about 50-50. Okay, some of you going, hang on, right? Yeah, anyway, not very bright, this crowd. All right. So what I'd like you to do now is change. Just change. Lefties go right, righties go left. Now, how does that feel? How does that feel? I mean, it's just not right, is it? And what's happening at the moment is, if we had neural scanners on your brains are going, "Something's wrong, fix it." Because our brains are orientated towards sameness. What's interesting, though, is this, and they've done lots of experiments on this. If you did that 1,000 times, eventually that would feel normal. It would habituate in your brain and become the new norm. Okay? In organizations, those of us that lead Salvation Army churches, when we're seeking to bring about change, if we haven't done the first three properly, yeah, what will happen is people will hear about the chains, they go, ah, something's wrong, fix it. And that's called resistance to change. The Salvation Army Church I became a Christian in, I give thanks to God regularly for that church and what happened in that church. It was really cringy. Do you know what? We used to stand around in a big circle, hold hands, and sing Bind Us Together, Lord, on a regular basis. We actually used to do that. But the Spirit of God was in that place in the most remarkable way. We saw scores of people come to faith. It was remarkable. But in the early days of trying to bring about change, it was quite difficult. And on one occasion, the Corps officer said to me, would you come and help me, Phil? And we had three blocks of chairs. There was a block in the middle and two blocks on the outside. And we moved the two blocks of chairs on the outside from being straight like that to like that. Like that to like that. We would have got in less trouble if we would have sacrificed chickens on the platform in the holiness meeting. Be more interesting than most of the ones I went to as a kid. It would have enjoyed, you know. We could have sacrificed our own children and we would have got in less trouble than doing that to that with the chairs. Because what happens? Our brains are orientated toward the status quo. That's the way our brains are wired. So that when we bring in change, the reason we resist it is because we're orientated to sameness. That's the human brain. That's the way it works. We are comfort orientated. We are sameness orientated. We have a defense mechanism to stop us embracing change. The only way we will willingly embrace change is if we dissatisfy the status quo, there's an inspiring vision of the future, and we have a plan for which we are accountable. And so whatever change that you're thinking about that you'd like to make, be it in your personal life, which has really been the focus of our time together, leadership of self, how do I bring about change? These four things need to be present. And the only way that you personally will make bring about change in your life is to make yourself accountable to another brother. Say, would you journey with me this? And I spent a lot of years talking with believers. I spent a lot of time talking with Christian leaders. And one of the most extraordinary conversations I had was with a long-serving Salvation Army officer in his late 50s. And he was a friend of my father's, actually. And I had gone to speak in that division and do some stuff. It's in the UK. And he was responsible for driving me somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And we're driving. It's kind of late at night. I just remember it was dark. And all of a sudden, he starts to offload to me the challenges that his personal life and his marriage and all that. He just starts to offload to me. I'm sitting there thinking, why are you telling me this? I'm the last bloke I tell my problems to. Why are you telling me? You know, seriously, this is not a pastor here. Trust me, this is not a pastor. I'm kind of, my pastoral care goes, slap, build a bridge, get over it, move on. That's my pastoral care. That's about as good as it gets, you know. And he was, anyway, he starts on, and I'm sitting thinking, this is awful. So when he paused for breath, I said, are you talking to your mates about this? Are you talking to your friends about this? And do you know what he said? He said, Phil, he said, to be honest, I've been a Salvation Army officer for over 30 years. He said, I can't think of one person I call a true friend. And part of me felt sad for him. And part of me felt he was maybe a victim of circumstance. But part of me wanted to say, I didn't say, part of me wanted to say, why have you chosen to isolate yourself from people then? Because isolation is a choice. There's an amazing story. If we had more time, we could look into it. The story in the Book of Kings about this amazing dramatic story in the Old Testament about when Elijah takes on the prophets of Baal and Jezebel. If you're familiar with the Bible, you know this story, whereby King Ahab, this bad king, has got the whole nation of Israel worshipping this false god, the prophet of Baal. Baal was the god of nature and god of fire and everything else and wind and everything else. And so what does Elijah sets up this amazing situation where he says, look, let's see whose god is the greatest god. And here we have this sacrifice with these rocks and these animals and everything else. Why don't you call out to your god, see if he'll come and consume it with fire. So all the Baal prophets are cutting themselves and slicing. Oh, mighty Baal, bring your fire, come down, rain fire. Nothing. Elijah kind of comes up, hey, God, and then wow, the whole thing. So then it's one of those kind of slightly problematic Bible passages where they slaughter all of those priests that all work for Jezebel. I'm not quite sure what we do with that, but let's just put that aside just for now. And they do all that, you know. And because I thought he'd say, hey, come kneel before Jesus and meet him. But he didn't do that. He said, nah, let's just cut the heads off. Anyway, this is early day ISIS. And so they do that. And And then Jezebel says, so Elijah's just done this amazing thing. This brave man taking on the entire nation, taking on all of these prophets, the king, the queen, and he's kicked their butts. Amazing. And then Jezebel says, the queen, may God deal with me ever so severely. If by the end of this day I do not have this man dead, I'm going to kill Elijah. And then it says this, that Elijah ran off to a nearby town, left his manservant there, and then ran off into the desert, where he ends up under a tree, saying, oh God, take my life. Woe, woe is me. Pity, pity me. And goes off and adds his own little pity party, having left his mate in the town. And we do that all the time. When we're in a difficult place, we choose to isolate ourselves. Leaders here, leadership's a lonely experience often. I really do understand that. I really do. But isolation is also a choice. We choose to isolate ourselves, as Elijah did. At the point at which he needed his manservant, his mate, his companion the most, he isolates himself. If you want to bring about change, you've got to have accountability. You've got to have people in your life that are going to help you do these things. So I just want to offer this thing to you to think about, and then we're going to sing and have, and then go for our coffee. To think about this concept. Iron, and if you've got any questions about that chain thing, feel free to grab me a coffee. Iron sharpens iron as a man sharpens another. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17. Okay? Basically, men, women, they need each other because we hone and refine one another. Because when we make ourselves accountable, when we journey with people, genuine accountability takes place. How many Salvation Army officers here do we have in the room? Police, or retired, or current? Quite a few of you. You know, it doesn't work. James knows. It does. The accountability of our system doesn't work. Who's ever going to go and confess their sin, for example, to the division of commander, knowing full well that they're responsible for things? Who's ever going to do that? Now, if the division commander is a fantastic pastor, maybe. But within hierarchy, be it in the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, or the Salvation Army, our process of accountability doesn't work. The only process of accountability that works is the one I choose to make myself accountable to. It's the only way it works. And this is about that. It's about you and I choosing as men to say, I want to be the best that I can be for God, so I choose to make myself accountable. And I have this little formula, and it goes like this. L minus A minus T equals L. L minus A minus T equals L. L minus T. Minus team minus accountability equals liability. Because when the Church of Jesus Christ gets embarrassed, it's because often leaders have become a liability. Why? Because they had no accountability when they were vulnerable. It's not always the case, but we all know that's often the case. And that kind of isolation is a choice, gentlemen. So let's choose something different, shall we? Let me offer to you a view about Jesus. Really interesting how Jesus worked with different groups of people. So we have different accounts of Jesus working with groups of people in different ways. So Jesus worked with the 500. You know, there was the resurrection appearance to over 500 people all at the same time. Fantastic. Then, of course, he worked with 120. And then he worked with the 72. He sent them out two by two. Then there was this group of the 12 disciples plus four or five women. That was a group of 16, 17. Then there were the 12 disciples. Yeah. Then there was the three, Peter, James, and John. And then there was the one. So who was the one, Peter or John? What do we think? Peter, John? My view, himself. There's always one that tries. I crack the jokes. That's my job, okay? No, I think his closest friend was John. It's really interesting when you read the Gospel of John. It's absolutely hilarious. Throughout the Gospel, he goes, and Peter sets out for the tomb, but then he gets overtaken by the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's me, gentlemen, that's me. I'm writing the book, that's me. And Jesus turned to him and said to the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's me, everybody, that's me. I'm writing this book, it's me. You know, it's hilarious. The man's ego was extraordinary. It's really, why would you write that about yourself? It's extraordinary. Read it. It's what he says. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. I think it was John. Because Jesus was a good Jewish boy. And when he was dying on the cross, he turned to his mother and said, "Mother, see your son, John. John, see your mother." And as a good Jewish boy, you only give your mother to your best mate to look after. You wouldn't do it to anyone else. And as we know, Peter was bonkers anyway. So like, why would you give him to Peter? Seriously, why would you do that? So Jesus worked with people in different really interesting groups. This is my belief here, particularly with three down to one. Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him, for example, to the Mount of Transfiguration. Or Jesus took the three with him into the Garden of Gethsemane. Why? Because he needed them. We often view it as, well, of course, these were great teaching moments. Hey, boys, we're going to go up on this mountain, and there's going to be a shimmery thing, and Elijah, and all that kind of stuff. And you're going to build things, Peter, because you're a numpty, you can't think of anything else to do. And, you know, it's a teaching moment, boys. Hey, boys, look, I want you to come with me into the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm going to kneel by that rock. You're going to fall asleep. I'm going to be in so much anguish that drops of blood will come from my head. I want you to learn about how a leader suffers. Come into this workshop about leadership, boys. Really? You know, I think it was Jesus was saying, boys, I need you. At my point of greatest fear of vulnerability, I need my mates. So please come and tarry with me a while. They fell asleep and failed him, but as our mates often do. But Jesus took them aside because he needed them. And if the perfect incarnate Son of God needs his mates, how much more, brothers, are you and I? How much more you and I? Do you think he liked the idea that he said in front of his mates, "Father, please, if you can, take this cup of suffering from me. I'm scared out of my mind about being crucified. Please, take this cup of suffering from me." This was no workshop on leadership. This was him saying to his mates, "Please help me, because I'm thinking of bottling out of this one because it's so hard. I don't want to go through the cross. Please stand with me because you're my mates." If the perfect triune God needed his mates, how much more, brothers, you and I? So choose not to isolate yourself. Let me suggest to you just a model, and then let's sing and pray and think what we're going to do. If you want this slide, I can give you these slides. I'll make them available to Malcolm, and he can send them around. I worked with an athlete. I'm going to tell a story about him in the last session. And who came to the Sydney Olympics. And I noticed that around him, this athlete, he had 16 people. 16 people to help him be the best in the world at what he could do. He had an accountant. He had a lawyer. He had a masseur. He had two surgeons because he had a surgery on his foot. He had a weights coach. He had a jumps coach. He had a sprint coach. He had two travel agents. Why two? I have no idea. But he had two travel agents, etc. He had me. And there was a group of 16 of us that were around this man's life to help him be the best that he could be. So I started thinking about it. I thought, well, what about that for me? What does that mean for me? Who do I need in my life to help me to be the best that I can be? Why should it just be professional athletes? Why would that be so? So I came up with this kind of model. I call it the mental matrix. Mentor, a relational experience where one person empowers another by sharing their experience and resources. Matrix, an environmental substance in which a thing is developed. That word actually comes from the same Latin root word as a womb. Yeah, a place where something comes to birth and is created. So this is the mental matrix. Look at that. Isn't that cool? Isn't that clever? That is the extent of my digital capabilities. You just seen it there. That's as far as it goes, man. Like, come on. That does deserve a round of applause. See the way that happened? That was really quite impressive. Yeah, that was really quite impressive. I couldn't do it again, but I do remember learning how to do that once. Okay, so mentoring matrix. So let me suggest you kind of six types of mentors that you could have involved in your life in some way. If you want these slides, I'm very happy to let you have them. Okay, there's what they call coaching mentors. Coaching mentors are skill set mentors. They help you learn skills. They help you get better at certain things. So here's a coaching mentor. Sorry about the rugby boys. I thought your players were valiant. I thought they came so close. They had a couple of bad decisions from the ref, absolutely, but I do think the better side won on the day. Anyone disagree with that? Yeah. There's always one muppet. Anyway, so coaching mentors. And the other thing, this guy is a great coach. I think he's the coach of the World Cup. I think he has. From where you were as a team to where you ended up, I think he's obviously been the coach, but also is unique in that he's the ugliest coach in rugby world rugby. Yeah, seriously. Look at that. Seriously, look at that. That is one ugly coach. Anyway, but Coaching mentors are skill set mentors. They help us get better at stuff. So what is it you want to get better at? Find someone who's good at what you want to get better at and help them to help you. So I was a preacher for a long time. And I had three or four people who were preachers and said, would you listen to my tapes? Would you help me to get better? Would you give me feedback on how these things go, et cetera, et cetera? Because I wanted to get better. I wanted to be as good as I could be. Why wouldn't you want to be as good as you could be? Because God's given us a job to do, so you want to do it really, 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 really well. So have a coach. So that's coaching mentors. Secondly, a senior mentors, old girlfriend of mine. And that's unkind, but true. So senior mentors. Senior mentors are great people. And I think I'm rapidly becoming a senior mentor for a whole bunch of young men. Yeah. But when I first came out, when I was in my 30s, just a couple of men I had in my life who I'd regularly go and see. I was sharing yesterday with a couple of guys here. There's this guy, he's a senior pastor at a church called Holy Trinity Brompton in London. That's the home of Alpha, if you know about the Alpha course. And his name was Sandy Miller. And I would go and see him four times a year for 2 hours. And my job was to come with the questions. His job was to make the disgusting Earl Grey tea and give me those cheap rich tea biscuits. Richest church in our country, and they give me rich tea biscuits. Cheapskate. Anyway, and we would sit there and we'd talk. And I'd just fire questions at him as a senior mentor. And I remember asking him this question once. And I said to him, I said, and this was like, I've been doing the salami job for, eight, 9 years. And it was getting to that time where, the adoption had failed. So I wanted to set this thing up. Could I do both jobs? The young guy that was working with me, exceptionally talented young man, he was itching to lead something. And if, I didn't get out of the way, he was going to go do something else. And as someone who at his heart is really just an evangelist, I ended up in an organization like the Salvation Army, running an organization for Christians. And that needs to be done, but not by people like me. You need people like me out there in Babylon amongst people who don't know Jesus every day because I get to talk to them about it. Particularly when they're policemen stuck in cars, it's fantastic. So, and I would go, and I said to him, it was really great. I sat there, I said, Sandy, can you help me? I've got this real anguish. I said, when do you know when it's time to move on? When do you know when God wants you to do something different? And he always did the same thing, answered the question the same way. He said, and he pushed his glasses back on his nose. Every time I think, just get some new glasses. But because he didn't fit properly. He's like, for goodness sake, richest church in the country, get some new glasses. He'd go, and he pushed his glasses back. And he'd go, dear boys, I absolutely have no idea at all. However, and he came up with some nugget. And I'll never forget, he sat there, he said, it occurs to me that if the God of heaven, who created the universe, wants you to do something different, he probably won't struggle in telling you. you got me there, yeah. Fantastic. Senior mentors. So find them. If you are one, make yourself available. Because I'm looking out here, and there's quite a few people out here with a lot more gray hair than me. There's somebody out here, Gary Baker, that would like more gray hair than me. But, make yourself available. I don't want to speak for those in their 20s and 30s, so I can't pretend. But my experience as a mentor to a number of younger men is that this emerging generation are desperate for decent mentors. 50% of them in our society haven't had their fathers around, many of them, because their family sadly broke down at some point. At least 50%. And others are looking upwards saying, who can I follow? Who can I learn from? So make yourself available if you're a more mature type. And then, that's a scary picture. Good grief, look at that handsome young man. Anyway, so that's me when I was age 20 years of age. Look at that. Why we wear those stupid hats, I'll never know. But anyway, the idea is to make you look taller. So, no, it doesn't work, doesn't it? Yeah. So, four types of mentor. Number one, occasional mentors. I'm often an occasional mentor for me, but I speak of things like this. Someone says, have you got 10 minutes? And I'll go in. So, be hungry. These mentors are not about what the mentor does. They're about my attitude and hunger to learn. So, everybody I meet who knows more than me, I think I can learn from that person. So, I ask loads of people all the time. I say, can we have a coffee one day? I'd love to come and just learn from you. And sometimes they say yes, and sometimes they say no. Doesn't matter. I'm going to ask anyway. And when it happens, it costs me a fortune in coffees, but I learn stuff. So I call them occasional mentors. Peer mentors. Peer mentors have a critical role. I have a number of peer mentors. These are people who I've asked and given permission to speak into my life. Okay? And my friend Ian that's involved in helping me set up this Infinitum thing, I've known Ian for 30 years now. We've been journeying together for a long time. I would say he has been, probably by the exception of my wife, the single greatest influence upon my life, particularly my spiritual life. Because he's encouraged me when I'm down and he's picked me off on the floor. He's slapped me when I've got arrogant and cocky. He's helped me have a better perspective. He's served me. He's cared for me. He's challenged me. He's inspired me. He's done all those things. So peer mentors, they're critically important. These are people who are kind of in the same weight class of life as you. Okay? They don't want to be you, but they're in the same kind of similar stage of life because you share commonality. You got stuff in common. You're wrestling with similar stuff. And so they're invaluable. And their key job is to provide support and encouragement, to journey alongside. The Paul and Timothy kind of relationship, or the Jonathan and David type relationship, or they're people to be around, that you journey with. One might be a bit older, one might be a bit younger, one might know a bit more, one might know a little less, doesn't matter. But they're peers. They're in the same weight class of life. They're peer mentors. Then passive mentors. These are people who influence you and shape you, but you may never meet them. William Booth has been a passive mentor of mine for a few years. That's not because I met him in a seance, but because I read his books. Okay? And his thinking and his obsessive, almost psychotic belief that you can achieve impossible things. Hence that quote yesterday. That's inspired me. That's really inspired me. And did he get everything right? No. Did he make mistakes? Absolutely. Did he offend people? I mean, over hand, over fist. Did he have some bonkers theology? Read his theology on the New Jerusalem, which he thought was going to be London. I mean, the man was a bit nutty in all sorts of ways. But he got enough stuff right for me to look and go, I'm learning from you, son. I'm learning from you, son. And I'm so thankful to God that you did what you did, because I inherit that. And all those prayers that you pray that God hasn't answered, on all those promises God made me that as yet are unfulfilled to William and Catherine Booth, they're mine. They're yours. And all the prayers that I've prayed have not yet been answered. Afternoon, boys. And all the, you know, promises that God made that have not yet been fulfilled, they belong to Jared and his generation. They get passed on. They're ours. We take ownership of them. We make them ours. That's what passive mentors help us do. And then finally, self-mentoring. You take personal responsibility for your personal growth and your personal development. You take personal responsibility for that. And you seek to look for opportunities to grow and to develop and to become all that God could have you be and to fulfill your maximum potential in the world by actually taking your development seriously. And so that's a model. I hope it's helpful. Those four things, if you want to change stuff, be it in your personal life, be it in your marriage, be it in your business, be it in your church, whatever. Those four things have to be present. And the change will never take place unless those four things are present. And then the way we do that is by having people in our lives to whom we are accountable that can resource us and fill those gaps that we have, enable us to get those things done. And that is largely dependent upon you being a self-mentor, that your posture is one of learning. So I'm going to ask the band to come and join me, or the kids, as they're now called, if they would. Sorry about that. We're just going to wrap up in about 6 or 7 minutes' time. We're going to sing a song together. But I just wanted to put a challenge out there to you. And I want to ask you what your posture was this morning. What is your posture? What posture are you choosing? What posture are you embracing? Pete mentioned it earlier in his prayer. What is your posture in relation to the things we've talked about this weekend? So some of you, up until this point, you're not yet a follower of Jesus. You've not yet made that step. You've not yet said, you've gone from this, you're in this posture of, I'm thinking about it. And you've not yet said, yeah, I'm going to follow. You're still in that, maybe, maybe not, shall I, shan't I? And I've had this conversation, I don't know how many people, lots and lots of people over the years. I remember talking to a young man. His name was Bashara Ali. He was a Muslim in a university. He invited me to call him Baz. And we talked about faith and we talked about Jesus. And he had all these fantastic, really deep questions that I was struggling to answer, but did my best to answer. And at the end of it, having explained to him what it meant to be a follower of Jesus, and having explained to him what it would mean to kind of pick up that faith and give his life into the hands of Jesus, he sat there and he looked at the floor for what seemed to be an age. And then he looked me in the eye and he said, "You know what, Phil?" He said, "I will commit myself to follow Jesus today." I said, "Oh, that's great. Why is that?" He said, "Well, you haven't answered all my questions." I said, "Oh, great. Thanks, mate. Try my best." He said, "You haven't answered all my questions." He said, "But I've been to this point so many times before. Then I've gone off and tried something else. And I come back here. Then I've gone off and tried something else. Then I come back here. I've gone off and tried, and then I come back here." He said, "I will become a follower of Jesus today, because I always come back here. And I have nowhere else to go. And so I'll commit and I'll follow. And I'll work out the answers to the questions I still have as I follow." And so to those of you that up until this point, be you someone who for whom this is your first religious weekend, or be it someone who has sat in a Salvation Army uniform for 40 or 50 years, believe me, I've seen enough of those come to faith in Jesus over the years to understand that that's no guarantee of anything. We agree it should be, but it isn't. To move from this posture of, "Will I, won't I?" to shift to the posture of, "Okay, first step, I'm going to follow. I haven't got all the answers to all of the questions, and there are many, but I'll take that first step to commit and follow, just like John mentioned at the beginning of our service together." Okay? Others of you, maybe in this kind of skeptical space, you know, you come to these events, you come to Salvation Army events, you come to stuff week in, week out, and you're in the transit lounge of life. You're in the transit lounge of life. You're just like, you're not in and you're not out. You're just in the transit lounge. You're partly committed, but you're not committed. You're partly involved, but you're not involved. You're just in the transit lounge. And you pick and choose, and you come to church to consume. You're a consumer. You're not a contributor, you're a consumer. And your posture is one of consumption rather than contribution. And God would say to you, very similar to those that he might say, "Come follow me," to do the exact same thing. To follow Jesus is not to be in the transit lounge. To follow Jesus is not to be in the consumption mode. To follow Jesus is to be a contributor. So I want to encourage you to get out of that cynical place of just consuming the transit lounge and commit everything to it. And for those of you also, and I've spoken to two or three of you over this weekend, your posture may be, "I've done my bit. I'm 72. I'm 85. I'm 68. Whatever. I've done my bit. My job now is to sit." And your posture is one of, "I'm done. I now leave it to the..." Sorry, we keep using you, Jared. Forgive me. You haven't got to do all this on your own, by the way. Most of it, obviously, but not all of it, yeah? You know, I'll leave it to the Jareds of the world. My job now is just to sit. I'm retired. Well, let me say, gentlemen, there's no retiring from this particular war, because it's still raging. And the only moment you get to retire is when Jesus said, "Okay, come home, son." It's a wonderful story about a very famous preacher in the UK. He was a revival preacher in the 1900s. And he would get up very early every morning. He says after his wife had died, and he'd kneel and he'd pray next to his bed every morning. Then one morning, he had a housekeeper. The housekeeper came in and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And there was no reply. Said, "Hello, doctor." No reply. And kneeling by his bed praying, he died by his bed. And the guy who was commenting on this event said, "You can just imagine the guy's kneeling there praying for the world and praying for a virus and say, 'Oh, Lord,' he get, 'Oh, oh, hello.'" This kind of, you know, this is like seamless moment of, "Oh, wow, those are new curtains." You know, you can imagine it, can't you? Just kind of hit this new space. Just this seamless transition. All right, so where was I? You know, you can imagine that kind of thing, you know. And I want to say to the more mature gentlemen here, whatever you do, do not think anyone's giving you permission to retire from this particular war. There is no retirement. So kick on, gentlemen. Get out of that posture of, "Now up to the kids," and kick on. Demand more of yourself. Expect more of yourself. Offer more of yourself. Give more of yourself. Because your most fruitful years could be ahead of you rather than you're behind you. And you may only have 5 left. So you better get on with it. So I just want to say, as we finish this morning, what posture do you need to shift? Do you need to get out of that, maybe I will, maybe I won't, and just follow Jesus and take that first step? Do you need to get out of that transit lounge about, well, yeah, no, you're just in consumption mode, you need to get involved? Do you need to get out of that mode of, that posture of, well, it's up to them now, it's, I've done my bit, whatever. If God is demanding of you a shift in posture, if anything we've talked about over these last couple of days has said, it's time to shift the posture, son, I want to encourage you to do that. So as we sing and worship together, we might go over time a little bit, but that doesn't matter. You might want to come and kneel and pray here and say, God, it's time to shift in posture. I want to become a follower of yours. I want to get out of the transit lounge. I want to go again. I might be 86, but I want to go again. I want a new season and a new time of effectiveness. I want to give again. And when I do transition to the heavens, I want to have nothing left in the bank because everything is spent. Because there's no retirement from this particular war. So what are you going to do? So let me pray. Shift your posture where you stand. Shift your posture as you kneel here. Shift your posture as you talk to a mate. It doesn't matter. But if God is saying it's time to shift your posture, son, I really would encourage you to do that as we worship together. Let's stand, gentlemen, shall we? Gracious God, Spirit of God, we say to you, we love you. We are so, so in need of you. When you look at the needs of our world in Africa, in Syria, right across this world, when we look at the needs of this country, of this city, of these communities we live in, of our families, we say to you, Jesus, we need you. And so, Lord, whatever posture shift is required from us, whatever different place that we need to be, however we need to reframe who we are and what we're about, God, in these few precious moments, may there be no unfinished business as we leave here today. But may we take those steps to you and shift our posture and truly follow you. Amen. In these moments, gentlemen, shift your posture as God would have you do.